On Tech News Today, a jury reaches a verdict in the Apple-Samsung patent lawsuit. Nobody's going to like it. Amazon lets you shop without leaving Twitter. And Google's thinking about killing off the URL. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, May 5th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Selena Larson, a journalist who writes for ReadWrite. Welcome, Selena.
Thanks, Mike.
So glad you're here and so glad you brought a wall full of bricks. You fit right in. And I'm really glad to have you here. This is a very, very special episode for us, Selena. This is our 1,000th episode of Tech News Today.
Oh, congratulations. I had no idea.
Yes, thank you so much. So this is a huge milestone for us. Of course, Tech News Today was launched by Tom Merritt on June 1st, 2010. So it's been almost 4 years. And it's had a long range of co-hosts, including Sarah Lane, of course, Ayaz Akhtar, Becky Worley. Darren Kitchen has been a very frequent guest, co-anchor, or I guess they didn't used to call him co-anchors, they used to call him co-host, Dr. Kiki Sanford, and some guy named Jason Howell, something like that.
Yeah, Ho and Well, it's they're pronounced separately, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess that person is lost to the sands of time. Actually, how long have you been doing the show? When did you start?
I started, I think, 3 or 4 months after the beginning of the show. I think it started in June, it started pretty close to now, actually. And I think I came over in September. So it was about 4 months in.
Wow.
So
okay.
I don't know what episode number it was. It was probably 200s, right around there, I'm guessing. Yeah. Just off the top of my head, hundreds maybe.
Well, congratulations to you as the sole remaining surviving veteran.
Excellent.
It's an awesome milestone. It's one thing to launch. It's hard enough to launch a successful show. And it's really rare to launch a show that has longevity and continues to grow year after year like this. And we keep evolving it, and we still plan to evolve it further. So congratulations to everyone who's ever been involved in this. And we thank all of you viewers for hanging in there and enjoying the show over the long run. So thank you all for that. And before we get into the news, I also want to remind everyone that we are using the Pixel Core Question Engine. Pixel Core Question Engine is essentially a question and answer system that's being developed. It's currently in alpha, beta, whatever you want to call it, by Pixel Core, Alex Lindsay's company, which we share an office space with here. And this is a brilliant it's system that I really have loved. We've used it twice, really only used it once, but we've used it twice. And the way it works is that you can watch the show on the page, and just below the live video, you can ask questions and then vote up or vote down other people's questions. And then I see the ranking right in front of me here on an iPad. And it enables me to know which are the most popular questions, which I can answer on the air or I can answer in writing or whatever. So I recommend that everybody try this. This is going to be an ongoing trial. We still have the chat room, which I still am going to be referring to. But the question engine is an experimental product, and we want to see where we can take it and how it will work. And I see some questions popping in as we speak. So, Selena, what do you say? Why don't we get into the news?
Sounds great.
All right. Well, a federal court jury reached a verdict in the Apple-Samsung patent lawsuit that we've been telling you about for the past couple of months. The outcome was a mixed bag for both companies. The jury ordered Samsung to pay Apple $119.6 million in damages, million with an M. They wanted $2.2 billion with a B. And they ordered Apple to pay Samsung about $158,000. You know, who knows how much they wanted. And with us to explain this outcome, which I suspect nobody is happy with, is Ian Scher, who's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you.
And also Chris O'Brien, who's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, Chris.
Great to be here.
All right, so Chris O'Brien, I'll start with you because you're on the screen. Who won this case? I can't really tell.
Well, there's no clear-cut winner, although I would say it's a split verdict that probably leans heavily to Samsung for the reason you sort of referenced. I mean, Apple was seeking $2.2 billion with a B in damages, and they got $119 million with an M. So, you know, the jury split down the four patents that were on trial, said Samsung violated two of them, but it sort of, in a sense, said, well, it's really not such a big deal as Apple's making out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ian Scherer, I have the feeling that Apple pursues these lawsuits against Samsung because it wants to make a big impact on the rest of the industry and on Samsung and on the public, which is that Apple invented many of the conventions that smartphone uses, that many of the things that Samsung and other companies have been using in their Android phones are copies or ripoffs of Apple products. That's a controversial point. Some people think that they are more or less right about that. Other people think they're full of hooey, and still other people think that maybe they did invent some of these things, but they should just be generally used conventions. And of course, bringing up the rear is the problem of patents in general and patent trolling and the whole patent mess in the United States. So this seems to me like a, you know, I would agree that this is essentially a defeat for Apple. I don't know if it's a victory or defeat for Samsung, but it's clear defeat for Apple because they didn't make the point they wanted to make, did they?
Well, it's kind of debatable. Apple obviously in their statement feels that they had some sort of a win, but definitely, I mean, the thing you have to think about is that all of this is symbolic, right? Even $2 billion is chump change for these companies. And so what's really going on here is that Apple is trying to, as you pointed out, really make a statement, hey, we invented this stuff and we deserve to be compensated because this is our technology. And so far, that as you've noted, they've had a mixed bag in the courts. They've been able to win on some things and not others. Samsung has become the primary people that they're suing, primarily because Samsung is the largest Android maker at this point. And they are the biggest competitor for Apple. It's interesting, actually, the two patents that the jury said that Samsung had violated or infringed were two of the kind of dramatic ones that you could think of. Slide to unlock, for example. I don't know if you remember, but when the iPhone first came out, one of the things that a lot of people were really interested in was the fact that you just slid your thumb across the screen. Now we all do it every day. So that's one of the patents that ended up winning. The other one was data tapping, which is like if you tap on a little phone number and suddenly you get all this information. And then the judge had actually earlier decided on a fifth patent for autocomplete, where you type in someone's name and you get it wrong. And it says, oh, by the way, it's actually this. That was another one that Apple, so far that patent seems to have stood up. So, you know, what Apple has now is they're able to say, look, this technology that we have, the courts have said that this is our patent and that it's valid. And one of the things that's interesting about all these patent battles is that the USPTO, the patent office, can issue a patent to a company, but when it survives in court, it has much more power. And so there are two patents that have gone away, but there are three patents that have survived a court kind of going through it. And now they're able to say, look, this is our technology. They're able to go to any Android handset maker that they haven't settled with already and say, this is a powerful patent now.
Now, Ian Scherer, this makes me think that the slide to unlock feature in Android and the autocomplete feature in Android needs to go away now. What happens now in terms of the user interface in Android?
Well, none of this stuff has to go away. So what's likely going to happen eventually is a settlement. And it's just we're counting down the clock until that happens. And really what you're seeing in all of these lawsuits is there is a lot of jockeying for power in the settlement room. So right now, Apple has either an upper hand or a lower hand, depending on how you look at it and the way that you see how powerful these patents are. And eventually you have all these lawyers stacking up what's the value of each patent on each side and then saying, okay, well, you know, this is worth this is worth that, and this is what you owe us in the end. But all of this is about settlement. And that means that a cross license eventually for these patents, because let's be honest, the cat's already out of the bag. The potatoes are on the floor, whatever analogy you want to use. There's no way that they're going to be able to take these technologies out of Android phones. And at the end of the day, again, Apple feels as though that already this technology has been violated. So now they want some sort of compensation. They want to be recognized and financially somehow give, you know, recompense for all of this.
So, Chris O'Brien, what's next in this particular case for these particular patents? The court case is still not completed yet, is it?
That's correct. I mean, as we're talking here, they're back in the courtroom actually dickering over some of the some minor amounts of the verdict math that the jury came up with. The jury basically had a choice of going back and fixing it Friday night or going home for the weekend, and they chose to go home for the weekend, which is understandable. You know, I would suspect they're going to, both sides are going to scrutinize it heavily. And I expect that Apple, I mean, the other potential win for them in all this is they get some sort of product ban or injunction to try to block some Samsung products in the market. And that, again, you know, goes to the challenge of these types of things. I mean, I don't know if we've said this explicitly yet, but, you know, the products at issue in this case are 2, sometimes 3 years old. And so, you know, when we're talking about what violated a patent and what they have to do to get around it and what could a product injunction mean, I mean, we're talking about things like the Galaxy S3 at a time when the company is focused on selling the Galaxy S5. And so, you know, how much impact all this has practically on what Samsung has to do to comply with it is going to be unclear for a while, but I think it will be minimal. And of course, then you get into the issue of, you know, appeals ad infinitum, probably from both sides.
Now, Selena Larson, somebody in the chat room named Jesse from Birmingham, Alabama, asked the question as to whether these patent cases hurt the brands. Is it bad for Apple's and Samsung's reputation, probably Apple's reputation more than Samsung's, that they're so litigious about patents and so aggressive about patents? Do you think this hurts them at all?
Ultimately, I don't think so. This doesn't really harm the consumer in any way. As they were saying, that the Samsung is the real winner here, right? So they paid a small nominal fee, which is really a drop in the bucket, and they still have a huge market share on mobile devices. So while Apple says they did get sort of a win, right, that said they were infringing on their patents, however, it's not going to stop consumers from purchasing Samsung phones. They're still growing in Android market share, and ultimately, consumers don't really care about court cases. They just want great phones.
Interesting. So, Ian Scher, this, you know, this, of course, is with obsolete phones, as you pointed out. Are there going to be additional court cases here? And I guess the other part of that question is, to what extent are these aggressive lawsuits a legacy from Steve Jobs, who declared thermonuclear war on Google over Android, and who was very vocal, if you recall, in the 2007 announcement of the iPhone, that, boy, have we patented everything. They really came at this with it from a patent perspective because Apple felt like they'd been burned in the past from intellectual property. Will the Tim Cook version of Apple over time soften Apple's stance, do you think, on patents and patent lawsuits?
Well, there's been no sign of it. He certainly said that he hates lawsuits, and he's claimed that this is not fun. And certainly we all look at the amount that the lawyers are getting, and they're really the winners in all of this, right? But there's no indication that he's letting up either. And Apple has continued to fight in every lawsuit. There have been they've gone to the International Trade Commission, which is an injunction court in D.C. They've gone all over the globe. They're fighting in courtrooms everywhere. So if he truly didn't really believe in this, then we probably wouldn't see as much of it. There is definitely Apple, you know, Steve Jobs set them on this course. And there's no question that there's a lot of language that you can pull from statements that he made publicly, statements in his biography that you can pull out that show that he really believed in these lawsuits. But again, Tim Cook seems to be supportive of them as well. So when does it end? It ends when there's a settlement between the two companies and not before that. There's always going to be new devices. And unless somehow Apple and Samsung magically decide not to supposedly infringe one another's patents, you're going to see lawsuits just continuing and continuing until they get into a settlement room and they say, okay, fine, let's finally settle.
I'm sure that at some point Apple will look at Samsung and say, I can't stay mad at you. Look at you. Let's just make up and just work together for the good of mankind. No, I don't.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ian Scher, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today to tell us about this this lawsuit semi-conclusion.
My pleasure.
All right, you can find Ian Scher at WSJ.com, of course, which is the Wall Street Journal website, and on Twitter at Ian Scher, that's Scher with two R's at the end. And also I want to thank you, Chris O'Brien, for coming on Tech News today.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
You can find Chris O'Brien at LATimes.com and at O'Brien, O'Brien with an E, on Twitter. Thanks again. We're going to we're going to tell you about a wacky new feature that Amazon has rolled out. But first, I want to tell you about ShareFile. ShareFile is the secure way to send files of almost any size via email. If you actually add attachments, especially attachments that include documents that you think are sensitive in any way or you want to maintain some semblance of security with, then you haven't been paying attention to the news. Almost every day, it seems like there's a new horrible security problem of one kind or another, and that's even with secure websites that are having problems these days. One of the least secure things you can do is send an attachment with email. With ShareFile by Citrix, you don't send attachments, you send a secure link, and that link gives you tons of control over your attachment. For starters, it can tell you exactly when the person opens or downloads and opens the attachment. It can also enable you to limit exactly who can see the attachment and for how long or for how many times. For example, you can say, okay, I'm going to send this attachment. The person can download it three times. After the third time, it is no longer downloadable. That's a very powerful feature. And again, it gives you all kinds of control. Now, lots of people use ShareFile because it can enable you to send enormous files, multi-gigabyte size files, very easily. And if you've ever tried to send a big file into any sort of company of any size, you know that they often have firewalls that block big attachments. This will get right past those firewalls so that your attachment can get into the right hands. And a lot of people use ShareFile because it's so secure, because they don't want their attachments falling into the wrong hands. But I like to use ShareFile for both those reasons and just for any sort of attachment, because sending an attachment just simply doesn't make sense. That's kind of an old-fashioned way from like 10 years ago to send files around. The right way to do it is to put it in a secure place in the cloud, send a secure link, and have that person be able to download things and give you information back. That's the ShareFile way. That's the modern way to do things. And so I want you to try ShareFile. It's super easy to do. Sign up today for a 30-day free trial. No obligation at all. Just go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TNT. That'll tell them that you learned about this from Tech News Today. And remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TNT. You really owe it to yourself to use ShareFile. Well, Amazon launched a new service this morning that lets you add products to your Amazon shopping cart with a single hashtag. Now, this is kind of an interesting story, and with us to explain it is Nathan Oliveris Giles, who is with the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now. Welcome, Nathan.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Now, why would anybody want to shop from Twitter?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but Amazon says that a ton of their affiliates and a lot of the customers use Twitter and use Twitter as a way to, you know, follow people who are selling things that they like and to kind of find products that they want to buy. That being said, me personally, I've never really used Twitter to figure out what it is I'm going to, you know, purchase, but this is something that Amazon says people do.
Now, how does this work exactly? I'm not really clear on how this would go about. I mean, so it starts out with a tweet that has a product in it, and then you retweet, or exactly how does this work?
Yeah, well, the first step actually is that you have to connect your Twitter and Amazon accounts to one another. So after you've done that, basically you're giving Amazon access to all of the tweets that you send. They cull in all these tweets and they're able to kind of sift through them and view them. As you're perusing Twitter after you've connected the two accounts and you see a link, maybe say to a new video game or something like that, that you want to buy, you can respond to the tweet that has the link to the product that you want with the hashtag Amazon cart in the US or Amazon basket in the UK. It's only available in those two places right now. And then after you've done that, it basically sends a signal to Amazon saying, hey, add this to my cart. So they've set up an automated script on their side that culls through your tweets and then looks for the script. And then when they looks for that hashtag, and when they find that hashtag, they just basically, you know, take the linked item and paste it into your cart. That's kind of the idea anyways.
Selena Larson, does this sound like a compelling feature of either Twitter or Amazon to you? Is this something you would use?
Me personally, no. I think the biggest question here for me anyway is how will people feel about publicly sharing their shopping cart? I know personally when I'm doing a lot of online shopping, it is a very intimate or personal interaction. A lot of things that I buy, I read a lot on Amazon, for instance, and I generally don't really share the number of books that I'm reading or the clothes that I'm buying or the shoes that I'm buying. So I think to me, that's the biggest issue. Because Twitter is a public platform, anytime you tweet Amazon cart or Amazon basket, people will be able to see what you're using. Again, Twitter has actually tried this before with Tweet a Coffee and again with American Express. And just a cursory search this morning for a couple of those hashtags, I didn't see that it was catching on among the masses. And I have yet to purchase anything with a tweet myself.
Now, Nathan Oliveros Giles, this sounds like something Twitter clearly wants to happen. And, you know, they want commerce to take place. They want to be, you know, kind of like Facebook. They seem to have Facebook envy. And we're actually going to talk a little bit more about that later in the show. But, you know, how do you do that? I mean, Twitter doesn't seem to me to be the place where anybody would want to buy things, shop, you know, do any of this kind of stuff, add things to their cart, any of it. Am I mistaken about that? I mean, is there some future on Twitter for commerce?
You're not mistaken about that at all. It's actually a problem that that's kind of persisted in social networking for a while. I mean, you brought up Facebook. That's a really great point. I don't know if you remember, but a while ago, you were able to buy like Tide detergent off of Tide's Facebook page and things like this. You're not even really seeing that anymore on Facebook. No social network has really successfully turned themselves into an online shopping, you know, marketplace. Amazon is Amazon for a reason. iTunes even had its little social network for a minute, and they shut that down because right now, just as we've talked about, when you go and you buy something, it's not exactly something that you always want to share. You don't always want to tell people what's in your grocery basket when you're going to the grocery store, and it's really nobody's business what I'm buying on Amazon either, or at least that's the attitude. So there's a big kind of cultural norm that all these social networks have to overcome. That being said, it's very important for Twitter to become that throughput to shopping because they want to get advertisers to spend their money on their platform. Facebook, Twitter, all these folks make a lot of their money from ads. Google and affiliate links is something that Amazon has been using for a long, long time. So if they can turn Twitter into a place where you find affiliate links, where you shift people over, then yeah, I mean, there could be a future there. But you know, shifting people over into Amazon versus actually getting them to announce all their purchases and essentially be free advertisers for you. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be a really tough sell.
Well, I agree with you there. And Nathan Oliveros Giles, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. You can find Nathan Oliveros Giles at WSJ.com and on Twitter at NATEOG. All right, well, Apple has hired at least 6 more biomedical experts and other medical experts of varying types, according to a new Reuters report by Christina Farr. Now, Selena Larson, this is, pretty obvious now that Apple is going huge. They're going very big in this medical thing. They're not just dabbling around with little sensors and just allowing end users or app developers to determine what the usage is. It sounds like they're hiring some serious big guns in the medical, you know, and this isn't just, you know, pedometers and heart rate things. It sounds like they're hiring people who are serious about medical sensor technology. Do you think there's anything beyond the rumored iWatch or iBracelet or whatever it's going to be called other than this? Are they going to build a health-oriented site, or where is this going, do you think?
So it makes sense for Apple to get into wearables to start. The iWatch is obviously a big thing right now with everybody wanting to be, you know, the next thing on your wrist. Right now, a lot of the fitness trackers and fitness sensors aren't super great at monitoring your vitals, right? So like it's almost impossible to have blood pressure or your heart rate. They're not perfect yet. I think Apple has the advantage here where if they roll out something like the iWatch that can do all of that. For instance, even other wearables like the EarPods that could monitor your heart rate as well. I think they could really have the leg up in the market. I would like to point out that 9to5Mac has been really great about sort of collecting all of this information about the potential health book, which is rumored to be a standalone application on the new iPhone. And it could have all of your personal biomedical information right there as an app. And I think that because it makes so much sense for people that already have an iPhone, and now with the 5S with a fingerprint sensor and the M4 chip, it makes it very easy to connect all of that together, sort of bridge the gap and become the ultimate wearable health device. So I think we can definitely expect that from Apple. As far as going forward to be a complete health management technology, I think that it's still very early, but it looks like Apple is gearing up to potentially do that in the future.
Hmm. Very interesting. Well, Google is thinking about killing off the URL. No, I'm serious. They're sort of kind of thinking about that. In a new version of Google's Chrome browser, the URL is not visible to the user. Instead, you see a Google search box. And now, this is a kind of a fascinating development. Again, this is just a test that they are testing, but a couple of analysts online are saying that they really believe that this is the way it's going to go. Essentially, the purpose of this is to hide an unsightly relic of the ugly past of URLs. Of course, Google had previously killed off the need for www and HTTP and all that kind of stuff. Not HTTP. You get the idea. The whole, everything, that whole string of text that comes before the actual URL. Nowadays, you can just put in twit.tv and it just happens. But they're talking about hiding all of that. Part of that, Selena Larson, is that this would help alleviate phishing attacks. Do you think the world is ready for browsers that don't show you the URLs?
You know what? I think so. I mean, how many of us are so used to using our mobile devices and using apps? And in the app, you generally don't see the URL. There's nothing in an app that can relate to a URL on a web page. So I think it will definitely help with phishing attacks, for one, which is why they're talking about this. But also, it's kind of mirroring the experience on the app-first, mobile-first world that we're living in. So I think, yeah, it's definitely a good idea.
All right. Well, Selena Larson, we had Robert Scoble on the show Friday, and we talked about the rumored death of Twitter and Google Plus, which people are talking about online. We concluded that nobody's dying, nobody's going anywhere. These social networks are both doing fine, and they're going to be around for a long, long time. But on Friday, at the same time we were talking about that, you wrote an interesting piece, or published an interesting piece, about the future of Twitter. And in that post, you said that Twitter needs to radically change in order to transform it into something for the masses. Now, what did you mean by that? How does Twitter need to change exactly?
So as we noticed on the earnings call last Tuesday, Dick Costolo didn't refer to Twitter as the town square, which is a phrase that he's been using for a very long time. He referred to it as a companion app. The town square mentality is really about what's like news and events happening around you. You go there for up-to-the-minute events and updates. A companion app is more what's happening around you, but you can share it and learn from others and really participate in the community. For instance, the second screen experience is a great example, using Twitter as a companion to the television or even to Netflix or Amazon, whatever you're doing, instead of having it be up to the minute late breaking news. I think Twitter, I've written this before, but I feel like Twitter still has an identity problem. Many people don't actually know how or why they should use Twitter. The Twitter elite, which I like to consider the early adopters and people that know how to use the hashtags and participate in the Twitter canoes. We've been using it for a long time for a specific purpose. For instance, getting news and seeing what's happening all around us. But as we've learned with the news industry, a lot of people don't necessarily like news and events, and they don't have to be up to date at all times. So I call it the Facebookification of Twitter, essentially making Twitter a more friendly platform. It's going towards the visual web by implementing large pictures. It completely redesigned the profile page to make it look even more like Facebook. And I think it's doing all that to be more inviting to people that are used to the Facebook experience. They're used to the Pinterest experience. They're used to not so much text, but more photos. And I think in doing so, it's making it easier and more accessible for both new users and people who have might abandon it because it was just too much real-time words in their face.
Yeah. Now, I think it's a questionable strategy personally, because even though everybody uses Facebook, and they use Facebook because everybody's on Facebook. That's where the people are, that if you want to talk to everybody you know and all your old high school friends and your former colleagues and your extensive relatives and all your friends and everybody, you go to Facebook. That's the only place where everybody is gathered. But nobody likes Facebook, do they? I mean, Facebook is not a site where people go, wow, I just love the features and the ease of use of Facebook. That's why I use Facebook. And here Twitter is sort of remaking themselves. Twitter is a site that people like the user experience of, and they're kind of remaking themselves into a site that nobody likes the user experience of. Do you think this is a mistake, or is this a good idea?
I personally don't like it. I'm very vocally against all the changes that Twitter is making, because I like it that it's sort of a confusing place. There's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of banter. There are those confusing hashtags. I think that what Twitter is ultimately going to have to do is sort of find the middle ground. I think, for instance, the ripping off of the Facebook profile page into the new Twitter profile. Personally, I didn't like it. I did see a lot of my friends and followers who aren't necessarily in the sort of the tech circle. A lot of them really liked it. But I think that Twitter is definitely going to have to find that middle ground where they make the user experience great and easy to navigate and easily understood for users. But there's also going to have to be that that piece that sort of stays away from blatantly copying Facebook, because Facebook really has turned into quite a bit of noise. I mean, people definitely still use it to keep in touch with friends and family. But even Facebook is trying to rip off some features from Twitter, like the being a news service and hashtags and having trending topics. So they're really, Twitter, in order to sort of appease everybody, is really going to have to find that middle ground of being friendly and accessible like Facebook to new users, but also not lose its identity of being a source of real-time news and events, as well as that companion app that DeCostolo was talking about.
Absolutely. I think it's a risky strategy personally, because you know, Twitter has already won the hearts and minds of the elite media types. Every journalist is on it. They get tons, mm-hmm. as you pointed out, of exposure on mass media and on television and so on. And that's a pretty great thing. That's something that they have that they have more of that than any other social network, including Facebook. Mm-hmm. So they really run the risk of losing those people in their attempt to gain the masses who may never come on board of Twitter. Maybe the ultimate destination of Twitter and in fact, Google Plus itself, maybe these are kind of somewhat niche elitist sites where people go to get away from the masses and to have something that's especially good for elites. And maybe the masses will remain on Facebook indefinitely. Mm-hmm. I think it's a risky strategy, and mm-hmm. I certainly hope that they at least retain some of the quirky, texty kind of attributes that made Twitter so popular in the first place among mm-hmm. the people who love it today, which is, you know, people like you and people, you know, people in the media and, you know, people who really have a good sense of how to use it and so on. So I think it's a risky strategy. But anyway, it was a great piece, and I'm glad you're on today for us to talk about it.
Thank you.
All right, so in a sec, we're going to talk about those Apple biometric earbuds you may have heard about. First, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the place to build a website. If you're going to build a website, and of course, if you have a business or any sort of projects, or you want to be a blogger or anything you want to do online, you really should have a website, because it's so easy and so pleasant to do when you do it with Squarespace. Why is this such a great experience? Well, you start with 25 beautiful templates. I mean, if you're looking at the video stream, you can see at first glance how beautiful, how well designed. These look like award-winning designs. I mean, they were really, really contemporary, beautiful designs. So you start with the template, and you go in and use Squarespace's easy-to-use tools to customize it. So your website will be completely different from every other website on the internet, even though you started with one of these templates. And it's very, very simple to use. But if you do need help, of course, they have live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I've used it myself. It's really a great help system, and the people who provide tech support really know what they're talking about, which is fantastic. Now, if you want to you build a website for your business, for your small company, there are two tools that you really need to know about. One of them is a logo creator tool. So you can go in and build a logo, even if you have no artistic ability, no design experience whatsoever. You can go in and tweak and customize your own personal logo that's completely unique. And then you can, of course, trademark it, and that will be your company's logo. The other feature that Squarespace offers is e-commerce is now available for all subscription plans. That's right. You can sell things on your website And if you don't have anything to sell, but you do need to raise money for your nonprofit or cash wedding registry or school fund drive, whatever, you can use that as well. It's very inexpensive. Squarespace starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And, of course, Squarespace is mobile ready for the visitors of your site, and mobile ready for you because you can monitor and check site stats using their Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad. So start a free two-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. That will get you 10% off the price and also show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, you may have heard a story in circulation about upcoming Apple headphones called EarPods that integrate heart rate and blood pressure sensors for biometric control, the kind of thing you see showing up in phones and on smartwatches, but this time in the earbuds. The story was covered widely, not only in the tech press, but also in the mainstream press, newspapers, network TV news programs. They all covered it. Well, it turns out that the story was fake. Sarah Perez at TechCrunch is reporting this morning that the story originated with someone who posted it as a joke on the anonymous app Secret. Selena Larson, doesn't this bug the heck out of you? I mean, this is a case where something becomes true because everybody's repeating it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is a perfect example of anonymous applications. We've actually seen Secret actually launch breaking news. And this is a case of where it was false, but it was almost so it could be true, right? As we've seen with the patent that Apple filed for EarPods that actually track the biometric information. So it could potentially be true. And as we talked about earlier, Apple is trying to get into wearables anyway, and this just makes perfect sense. So I think it's kind of funny that, you know, these anonymous applications can definitely launch rumors. I think that it's obviously important for reporters to do their due diligence and not necessarily report on a story just because somebody said it could happen on Secret. But I think it's a really great example of how these rumors can be spread. And it is actually really exciting if this does happen. Like we talked about earlier with Apple getting into wearables, I think it would be a really fantastic opportunity for them.
Absolutely. And let this be a lesson to everybody who wants to go out there and punk people. The way to make it believable is you make it feasible and make it current. In fact, this was made more feasible because Apple, in fact, does have some patents in this area that could be applied to biometric earbuds. It's feasible because everything seems to be getting biometric sensors in them. But that's how you do it. You do something that sounds like it would be exactly what's current with what's happening in a bunch of different ways. But in this case, it was a joke that somebody wrote in about 5 minutes immediately after waking up one morning and feeling like they wanted to play a joke on the world. So
how often does the news press have to be sent down a rabbit hole based on obvious, like, you know, in retrospect, obvious lies before they stop, like, turning to Secret for news stories? I don't understand it. I don't understand how Secret can be taken seriously, to be honest.
Well,
yes, there are truths there every once in a while, but how do you validate anything? You can't.
Exactly. Well, it's kind of, I think the onus is on us as reporters, because as we've seen, I mean, just with the Vic Gundotra rumor that he was leaving Google Plus and Nike firing their wearables division, we've seen that it actually can be a source for news. It's just really unfortunate that more often than not, it's just false rumors.
Yeah. And of course, going back, if you have 100 false rumors and one thing that's true, even if the person who said this true thing didn't know it was true, maybe they thought it was false and it just happened to be true by coincidence. That doesn't mean that going forward that you can take whatever you see on apps like Secret seriously. Hindsight is always 20/20. And, you know, the bottom line is that there's no substitute for good journalism. So kudos to those of us, including you, Selena, and me, Mike Elgin, who didn't report on this story. Because, you know, it's important, even if you do report on stories like this, to say what it is that is in fact the fact, that somebody on Secret said XYZ, not that XYZ is in fact true. You don't ever want to say that. We want to report the facts and not the truth. Because the truth is often untrue. Selena Larson, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today as our guest co-anchor.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're really great at this. I hope to have you back again very soon.
Certainly, anytime. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks again. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT, and we encourage you to do that. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Tech News Today. Follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. And we want to hear from you. Comment on Twitter or Google Plus using the hashtag Tech News Today. Or you can send an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. My name's Mike Elgin. This is our 1,000th episode, so thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.